It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what do a 1919 eclipse and cyborg rats have in common? They're both part of our monthly look at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. First, if you had to guess, when would you say recreational vehicles hit their peak popularity in the United States? Maybe the 1980s or 90s, sometime in the past? Turns out it may be right now. The RV Industry Association says 2017 was a record year for shipments at more than 504,000. In fact, they went up every year since 2010 until coming down slightly in 2018. Why the surge? They've become more comfortable, more modern, and easier to rent. Gas has also gotten cheaper. Maybe a bigger surprise is who's getting into it. It's not just retirees and empty nesters, but millennials. Our guests made the decision a few years back to sell their home and cars and quit their jobs. They now live, work, and travel out of their RV full-time and blog about their experiences. Mark and Julie Bennett are the husband and wife team who wrote the book Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. They blog at rvlove.com, and they're joining us on the road. Mark and Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
And let me ask, Mark, whereabouts are you right now? I heard something about Alabama. I heard something about Colorado. Pin it down for us.
We are currently in Fairhope, Alabama, which is near down the southern in the panhandle.
Okay. It looks like we've lost Mark actually for the moment, Julie, but that's okay. We've got you. What made the two of you decide to basically trade everything you had for an RV?
Well, you know, if you can't tell from the accent, Robin, somebody might be wondering, I'm Australian, but I've been living in the U.S. for 10 years. And, you know, my husband, Mark, and I, we had a great life living in Colorado and, you know, had jobs and commutes. And we don't have kids. We had a dog. And we were just really looking for ways to bring more travel and adventure into our lives. And when my husband found himself with a full-time job that he was able to do remotely from home, we started asking the question, well, you know, where is home anyway? And if he could do his work from anywhere using internet, mobile connectivity, maybe we could start doing more exploring and traveling of this amazing country. And that's when we started exploring the idea of living in an RV. And once we started researching, the idea got legs, and we just kept researching and finding that all of the big questions that we had were being answered in a way that we're showing that there are hundreds of thousands, if not over a million people doing this. And so 5 years ago, we sold our home, bought an RV, hit the road, and haven't looked back.
And as you travel around, I know you meet a lot of other people in RVs. What is the mix you see of people who are, you know, maybe taking that 2-week road trip on a vacation versus the people who are full time like you are on the road?
Well, the majority of people still with RVs are vacationers. You know, they go for, you know, weekends or a couple of weeks on a vacation. We've been full-time, but when we first hit the road, we found that we were some of the younger ones in the campgrounds, and they tended to be a higher percentage of retired people, particularly outside of school holidays, you know, and during the week. But what we're finding now, it's interesting, over the last 5 years, really seeing the change in the demographics in the campgrounds. We're seeing a lot more families with kids that are road schooling their kids. We're seeing a lot more millennials, a lot more younger people like us that, you know, in their 40s and still working and just discovering that this is a way to be able to do that. So it's been really interesting to see the change. We were among the younger when we started out, and now we're seeing, now we're starting to be some of the older ones.
Now, what is it? This might not be for everyone, but what is it that you love about living year-round in an RV?
You know, for us, I think it's really just about that freedom to be able to decide where you want to be and when you want to be there. And a lot of that is taking advantage of the weather. So, for example, we just spent 4 months in Florida for the winter. So we originally had our home in Colorado, and seeing family digging themselves out from 10 inches of snow after a big storm, and here we are in Florida at the beach, you know, sunning ourselves, and it really didn't even feel like we had winter at all because the weather was so great in Florida this year. So that was a huge advantage. And then, you know, we can go north in the summer. That's what we'll be doing this year. And I think one of the big things too is we really wanted to travel as far and wide as we could, and we've traveled to all 50 states while still working full time, because you're driving, you know, as part of your life. Like, we don't drive every day, of course. We might stay somewhere for 1 or 2 or 3 weeks, but instead of going somewhere and then racing back to get to work, we're kind of heading in one direction and just stopping where we want to go along the way.
We're talking about living on the road, either for 2-week vacations or full time. Julie Bennett is with us. Her husband, Mark, we're trying to reconnect with. They're the authors of Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. Looks like we have Mark back with us. Mark, are you there?
Yes.
Wonderful.
I am. Sorry. I don't know what the heck. Sometimes just drop, even though you have coverage, it just suddenly drops.
Yep, happens with any kind of phone. Well, I want to bring you in, Mark, and can you talk about the transition from living in a house with presumably, you know, the stuff you build up in a house to living in an RV? You write a chapter in your book about how to make that that purge before you hit the road.
Well, it is a big purge, and especially for people who are older demographic, people who have built a whole family in their lifestyle, in their home. That can be a really big job, not just physically, but also emotionally. It's a very big transition. For us, it took probably 6 to 9 months to be able to pull off. And, you know, just selling things at garage sales, selling things. And we actually were able to sell our home fully furnished, which worked out really well because we didn't have to get rid of any of our furniture.
And you also talk in the book and actually on your blog about a phrase I learned, boondocking. Julie, could you talk about that? This is, you know, instead of going to a campsite, you're just self-sufficient in the vehicle. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, we love boondocking. It was a term we'd never heard of when we started this 5 years ago, and then quickly learned that a lot of people do it, and that's part of the appeal is an RV allows you to really get out there and camp off grid in places that you wouldn't otherwise normally be able to get to. And what boondocking means is you're able to just use the amenities on board your RV to operate as if you're plugged in at a campground. So we have a fresh water tank for water, we have a generator for power, and actually now we have lithium batteries and a whole 1,000 watts of solar on our roof, so we can don't even need to run our generator anymore when we're out there literally in the boonies. You could be up in the mountains. We had a fantastic summer in July in Salida, Colorado, in some beautiful public land. There is a lot of public land, Rob, in America that perhaps people don't know about. It's being public land. We all own it, and we have the right to go and stay on it up to 2 weeks. There is a restriction. And, you know, obviously you do the right thing. You pack your stuff in, you pack your stuff out. This is to be cherished, and you don't abuse these free lands. But you can park in these scenic locations and just... One of our favorites is Sedona, Arizona, where we're parked on forest land. In fact, the front cover of the book, you'll see a picture of our first RV surrounded by million-dollar views in Sedona, and that was just parked on a dirt road. Waking up to that view every single day was just incredible, and it's a real sense of freedom, you know, to be able to do that and literally be off-grid. Literally be off the grid in terms of your power, your water. And we have holding tanks for, you know, sink water and shower water and the toilet, that kind of a thing. And then get to a campground and dump our tanks and go and do it all again.
We're talking about recreational vehicles and the people who live in them, either for vacations or all the year round. Mark and Julie Bennett are with us. They're a husband and wife team who quit their jobs, sold their house and cars, and now live, work, and travel out of their motorhome. They're the authors of Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like RVing either all year round or just for vacations? What do you like about it? Where have you gone? Where do you want to go? Do you work out of one? Do you find maybe seasonal work or work remotely for whatever job you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Great RV.
Thanks. It's a Roadbird Freedom 5000.
Where are you headed?
Oh, wife and I just drove down from Seattle. Don't know where we're going next, but it doesn't really matter when you're driving one of these puppies. Hey, honey, fry me up some steakums, will you?
RV scene from the King of Queens there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the growing popularity of motorhomes. Mark and Julie Bennett are with us. They're a husband and wife team who call themselves full-time RVers. They blog, teach RV courses, and they wrote the book Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you now or have you ever lived out of an RV? Do you have one that you like to take on vacations for a week or two at a time? Do you have a favorite memory, story, a place you visited in your RV, or a question for a guest? They've got a lot of advice in their book and on their blog. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Todd is with us in Janesville. Hi, Todd.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me on your show. I just like to make a couple comments. I think it's great that younger families are starting to do more RVing. My parents bought a big diesel pusher. My dad always wanted to have a Bluebird, and they ended up getting a diesel 40-foot diesel pusher Monaco. And it was just too big for them. And we have a 1973 GMC Sequoia, all original lime green. It's 26 feet. It's just a lot easier getting into places than you can with a big, you know, if you're going to be living out of it, it's a different deal. But for going, you know, for a week or a month out of it, you can get into more spots with a smaller coach. And I just recommend, you know, if someone's going to buy a coach, is to rent one for a month. You know, the 26 or 32 foot Class C, just to see, get used to driving, number one, and then, you know, see what they'd like to change on before they actually go out and buy one. My dad, there's just one trip to Florida and back, and it was on Craigslist.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, can you talk about that, trying to find the right size RV for a particular person or family's needs?
Yeah, I mean, we do recommend people look for the smallest one they feel they can be comfortable with in their travel, because it does increase your maneuverability and also your access to places to stay. But it depends on how much you're talking about. Similar to what that caller was mentioning, a lot of it has to do with your travel style. You know, if you're just going out for weekending, or if you're going out for shorter, less frequent trips, a smaller one might be able to do better for you. But for people like us who live full-time in it and work full-time in it, you definitely pays to have a little bit of extra space.
Todd, thanks for that call. We'll go to Connie now in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. We've had motorhomes for years and years and years. But what makes us so upset is our motorhome is in really great shape, but it's 17 years old. You cannot leave a motorhome in a park seasonally unless it's 10 to 15 years old. People don't know that. And for that price, how many people are going to trade like you would a car?
Connie, got it. Julie, have you run into that? You can't have an older RV parked seasonally in some parks?
Well, we obviously don't park seasonally because we're full-time, but there are a lot of RV parks that do have a 10 or 15-year age limit rule. And we've inquired about that. We haven't come across that to be much of an issue. Our coach is 2012, but our current coach is a 1999. And we actually just spent a week at an upscale RV resort, a motor coach resort, actually, in Jupiter, Florida. They didn't have an issue at all. They had a pride of ownership rule. But I think what Connie's point is very valid in that we did question a campground about this up in Portland, Oregon, and they said it actually wasn't their rule, but it was the city, because the older RVs in the electrical systems increases the risk of a fire, which can then impact other RVs and the park, of course. Now, I don't know if that's fact. That's just what we were told by the management of that park, but I thought it was a really valid response. In that these older coaches, one of the number one causes of fires is RV refrigerators. And, you know, it's easy for those to go up quick. And I'm not trying to scare anybody here, but just to be aware that, you know, these things can happen. And I imagine that some of the parks are trying to limit their liability because it would impact their insurance. So that could be a reason for it, and definitely worth asking. But, yeah, Connie, trading in an RV, it's these older coaches, there can be some good ones. Ours is 20 years old, and, you know, it's beautiful. We just did a full remodel on it. But taking RVs all the time to fit in that rule can get expensive for sure.
Thanks, Connie, for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Tom now in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have some property down in Texas. I'd like to do this with an RV. What's the cost? Do I pay by the mile? And then if I stay there a couple of months, do I pay by the month? Or how does the rental on one of these units work?
Oh, for renting, Tom. Mark, do you have a lot of experience with rental of RVs?
We don't have a lot of experience with rentals, but there's a lot of different types. There's the big chains you see that are like driving billboards, the Cruise America and stuff like that. There's also companies like RV Share that is basically more like an Airbnb where people are renting out their private units. They oftentimes have a mileage and a per day related to that. So it is a good option for people to get a first feel for how they like to RV. But then if you decide you want it, then obviously rental's not the best long-term solution. But there's definitely usually a per-day and a per-mile fee, and it will add up. Rentals are not cheap, but it's cheaper than buying the wrong RV from the get-go.
Tom, thanks for the call. Make sure you can still get the Ideas Network down there in Texas and keep on calling in at 800-642-1234. Mark and Julie Bennett are with us. They're the authors of Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. We're talking about a growth in popularity over the years for RVs, either as a vacation vehicles or living in full time as our guests do. And Mark, this to me, this would be a tough psychological change for me. I like having a home base that is fixed in one place. Can you talk about just some of the adjustments you have to make when you go full time living on the road?
Yeah, well, you know, there's quite a few people who do still like to have a home base if they're in the financial position to be able to hold on to a traditional home. That's a really great option to give themselves that ability to have something they can call home. For us, Julie and I, we were able to jump straight in, both feet, sold our house, and it was less of a transition for us. But I do see, especially for the folks that raise a family in their traditional home and then hit the road, it's a bigger transition for them. But I'm sorry, Julie, do you have input on that, too?
Yeah, I think one thing we don't miss, Rob, is all of the house and yard maintenance. Every time I see someone in the RV park mowing the lawn, we look out the window and think, oh, it's nice someone else gets to do that. But, you know, I understand what you're saying. I mean, a lot of people like to have that. You've got community, you've got your home and your things around you. And I think one of the things that it's one as much of an adjustment for us as people may think, because this is our home and we do have our things around us. It's not like we're living out of a suitcase like we would be if we're traveling on vacation and staying in hotels or just doing you go on a weekend or a week-long RV trip. You spend a couple of days planning for it, shove everything in the RV, you go off, have your trip, come back, and then it's a whole other job getting it all out and cleaning up again. But here it's very seamless. I mean, we've got our refrigerator, we've got our pillow, our own bed every night. Everything that we want and need is in the RV. So it's really the only thing that really changes is the location. And that can be pretty awesome.
Let's bring on another caller now. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
One other thing that was really interesting for us is that 6 months into our travels, we had a real profound moment when we had been home visiting family over the holidays and then flew back to where our RV was after spending a week with family in our hometown. And when we got back to the RV, we said, oh, is it so good to be home?
Oh, nice.
So over time, it actually becomes feeling more of your home than your traditional one did.
Let's go to Edie now in Baraboo. Edie, hi.
Hi. I'm enjoying this program. I go around for, probably 2 months or so at a time out of Baraboo, and I just have a utility van. I can't stand up in it. And when I bought it, there was nothing in it. It was just bare metal. So I had a bed put in, and I have a cooler that plugs into the cigarette lighter or electric if I'm at a campground, and a little porta potty. And I study all winter where I'm going to go and head out. And I love it. You can take all the back roads and meet so many interesting people. And you don't have to have something fancy to do this.
Yeah, Mark, thanks a lot for the call, Edie. I've seen people, I actually just saw somebody who was converting a retired ambulance that they'd bought on auction. I've seen people with vans and different vehicles. What's the variety you see when you're out on the road or at a campground?
Yeah, we see the variety run the gamut. In fact, the story this gal just shared on the phone, one of the people featured in our book in the RVer profiles has a very similar van and a very similar travel style and is able to travel very frugally. I mean, you can buy an RV, you know, or build your own pseudo RV as this woman did for just a very little bit of money, and you can spend as much as $2 million on some really expensive high-end custom coaches. So they really run the gamut. We see a lot of people spending between $50,000 to $150,000 on their full setup.
Thanks for the call, Edie. And Julie, Edie also mentioned the people she meets along the way. And I don't want to let the time get away from us without talking about that. What kind of people do you meet on the road? Do you feel a community when you're meeting other people who drive around?
Absolutely. And I'd say that is one of my biggest pleasant surprises. I was really concerned. I'm an extrovert. I like people. Was worried about leaving behind my community in my home. But what I found is our community on the road is just much bigger and more supportive than I ever would have imagined. We've got people, literally friends all around the country now. And RVs are helpful. You know, if something's going on, they're the first to lend a hand, help you out. If they see you trying to fix something on your RV, they'll come over and try and help you. It's really an amazing community, and that was definitely a really, really great surprise that completely exceeded my expectations.
And Mark, something that struck me in your book in our last minute or so, you describe you know, your life living in a home, commuting to a job that you had to show up in person at. You were finding it very stressful, and you found just a complete reversal now that you're living in an RV. Can you talk about how you find life so much less stressful now?
Yeah, well, you don't spend nearly as much time with that commute and with the stressors of regular life, and you are able to connect more with nature, which has an ability, for me at least, has a real grounding effect to lower my stress. So this lifestyle, you know, depending on how fast you travel, can be more stressful. But for me, it's really provided a new level of stress relief and tranquility, and regular lifestyle and work off of work.
All right, we'll leave it there. We'll watch for both of you coming up to Wisconsin in the near future. Thanks to Mark and Julie Bennett. They're a husband and wife team. They're bloggers, YouTubers, RV course instructors, and full-time RVers. They're the authors of the book Living the RV Life, Your Ultimate Guide to Life on the Road. A lot of advice in there for current or potential RV drivers. We talked to them about why RVs have been surging in popularity. They joined us from Fairhope, Alabama. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest science news from Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the federal investigation into inmate abuse at the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison is complete with no charges being filed. We'll look at the long-awaited decision and what happens next. Now it's time for our monthly check-in on the world of science with Discover Magazine. People across the globe were captivated by the first picture ever of a black hole. We'll talk about 100 years of Einstein's work on that subject and how some of his early theories helped lead to last week's groundbreaking news. And we'll take a look at the future of fertility and some rat cyborgs. Yes, rat cyborgs. Bill Andrews is Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Always happy to be here.
Well, let's hold the rats and the black holes for a minute, Bill, and look at the future of fertility. Now, you tackle some different angles on that story, big changes, even what might happen on Mars. What are some of the things you're focusing on there?
Well, it's been a big couple of years, the last decade or so, in biology and, you know, the lab work that people are able to do now, because there's this tool, this genetic tool called CRISPR-Cas9 that researchers can use to go into genetic codes and rewrite things very accurately, very carefully. So we look at how that and how different understandings of genetics and people's DNA profiles and how all these things might impact our reproductive choices, our reproductive abilities in some case. And so, for example, the CRISPR-Cas9 technology could go into making sure that babies in the future are not born with any predispositions to genetic diseases or defects or problems like that, which sounds great. But, I mean, anytime you're starting to mess around with our genetic code, with our DNA, it's time to also really be careful about what we're doing. People get really worried about that, and so that opens up kind of a whole host of issues involved in not just directly altering our DNA that way, but in being able to use our profiles, our genetic profiles, to maybe better select a different partner. If I know I'm susceptible to a certain disease, maybe I want to make sure not to choose a partner who also is susceptible to that disease to give any children we have a fighting chance. And so is that going to be, you know, a problem in the future? Is that going to be entering maybe on your Tinder profile or anything like that? And so it's just a whole realm of possibilities now that we're just starting to realize for this whole issue of, you know, making sure we have kids, maybe with a little help from science.
And finally, this idea of if we are, have humans in space or on Mars, how is reproduction going to work? Because we as mammals, we're built to breed here on Earth, and there are a lot of really different conditions when it comes to gravity, oxygen levels, things like that. This could be a major roadblock if we wanted to, say, have a Mars colony that sustains itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And not just on Mars, but in space as well. Like you mentioned, the gravitational differences, pressure, different chemicals in the air, different radiation going through all the spacecraft. All these things are different from conditions on Earth. And so far, no one's ever been pregnant in space. No one's ever done anything in space that could lead to getting pregnant. We don't even know if that's possible, if the physics of life even work the same way in space or how that would work. So there's still a lot of research involved in just trying to understand, is this even a thing that our species can do in space, on Mars, maybe other planets someday? And if it is, how would even that work? Would it be just kind of the same free-for-all, find someone you love and hope for the best, or would it be a different kind of a program involved to maximize your colony's chances of survival? I mean, there's all kinds of different approaches you could take here to try and figure out being able to survive as a species off Earth, which, you know, one day we're probably going to have to figure out how to do.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine about some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Okay, Bill, we have this year this 100th anniversary of eclipse, a solar eclipse that was pivotal in the science developed by Albert Einstein. Why was this eclipse such a big deal for him?
Well, this eclipse that happened on May 29th, 1919, which we write about in the May issue, is a huge deal for the science of relativity, for understanding how mass and heavy objects in the universe can warp the space around them. That was Einstein's kind of big work, and he'd been working on it after he developed special relativity. That was in about 1905, and that came out, and cool stuff with the speed of light and some new parlor tricks you can do. Cool. But then he really set to work for about a decade to work on his theory of gravity, on general relativity. And when that came out in 1916, it involved certain predictions, and it had a lot of fanciful ideas in it, stuff that even Einstein thought, this is what the theory says, but I'd be surprised if it happens in real life. For example, black holes. He was kind of skeptical about them at first. And so the big deal about that eclipse that happened in 1919 is it was the first chance that scientists had to test some of the predictions in general relativity, one of them being that objects that are really heavy, have a lot of mass, for example, the sun, should actually be able to change the direction of light that flows nearby it, which is kind of a heavy thing to think about. But if you compare light flowing to water flowing, you know, it'll follow the contours of the land. If the land shifts to the left, the water will go along with it. And so if light shifts around the warps of the sun, then we'd be able to see that difference. And so this eclipse gave astronomers a chance to really test the night sky without the sun, and then kind of a pseudo night sky because it's all shadow and darkness with the sun still there, only it's blocked by the moon. So they were able to see directly the effects of the sun's gravity on the light from distant stars. And they saw that it really did affect it. There really was a change. And so that means this guy Einstein with his crazy theories must actually be right.
And now Einstein there followed the math, and then they were able to make this observation. Another one of his predictions, that of gravitational waves, took almost another 100 years to confirm. But in 2016, news broke that gravitational waves predicted by Einstein had been detected. Here's a quick listen to what those waves, a representation of them, what they sound like. All right. So what is what's the big deal with these gravitational waves and how they might feed into, say, this picture of a black hole we just saw last week?
Yeah. So gravitational waves are super exciting. A couple of years ago, we in the Discover offices worked for weeks ahead of that story to make sure we were on top of it. We had diagrams, we had pictures, because it was such a big deal. I remembered very vividly. And it's because it's a whole new way of being able to study and effectively see the universe. And so normally we've been relying on light, on different types of light, like radio waves or gamma rays or X-rays, infrared. All those are basically just variations of light. And gravitational waves are something totally different. When heavy enough bodies, again, but this time something like black holes or neutron stars, really dense, really heavy bodies, when they do things in space, they not only warp the area right around them in space that would change the way that light flows, but they would also send out ripples through space, like a rock dropped in a pond sends out ripples on the water's surface. And so those ripples, when they get to Earth, are literally distortions in space-time. Dimensions of a cube would be a little shorter on one side and a little longer on the other side, just for a fraction of a second. And so by studying those, we can see a kind of a new window into the universe and another way of exploring black holes or neutron stars or heavy enough things that don't often emit a lot of light, don't do things directly that way, but their effects on the universe can be felt. And so now we can study them that way.
Yeah, so gravitational waves, just discovering them was a big deal. But now astronomers are like, okay, we can't stop there. We've got this Easter basket full of space goodies that we might be able to actually track down using gravitational waves, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's some boring sounding stuff at first, like, oh, different kinds of black holes, oh, you know, we can figure out the event horizons of black holes all the better. And to me, that isn't boring at all. It's already exciting. But I know that's old hat for a lot of people sometimes. But with gravitational waves, we can also look for things like extra dimensions. Not parallel dimensions in the way of like, oh, I have a doppelganger in another universe who won the lottery and now he doesn't work. But extra dimensions in the sense of more than just the three familiar ones that we're used to, length, height, and width. Maybe depending on how gravitational waves show up on some people's computers, if they ripple kind of a certain way, that could tell us that there's other dimensions that they're also rippling within. There's also stuff called strange matter that might be the makeup of some of the densest, heaviest neutron stars that are made up just of quarks, some of the constituents of protons and neutrons, and specifically the strange quarks. And they're weird because if anything touches this theoretical strange matter, it would become strange matter too, because it's so heavy, it just sends everything and kind of cascading like a dominoes falling on top of each other. And so different kinds of gravitational wave readings would also reveal if that matter really exists, if there really are stars out there made of nothing but strange matter. So just all kinds of goofy, crazy, interesting things going on that gravitational waves can now start to tell us about.
And Bill, before we wrap up, one more non-boring story. Research on creating rat cyborgs that can be controlled with the human mind. What?
Yeah, exactly. Not a big deal, right? Just your average story about rat cyborgs. And this is one I remember writing about for the website that got a lot of people excited, including us in the staff. And it's a scientific paper in the journal Scientific Reports called Human Mind Control of Rat Cyborgs Locomotion with Wireless Brain-to-Brain Interface. Scientists were able to hook up a human into kind of a special hat, and by thinking certain thoughts, that human was able to convince, compel, direct, mandate, whatever you want to say, a rat into moving left or right or forward through a maze. So we were able to make rats move just by thinking about it, which, you know, that's kind of crazy. But real science, peer-reviewed, absolutely the fact.
And this is something that theoretically other scientists will now try to replicate and see where they can take it?
Yeah, it's something that could help out with prosthetics, with communication. Another scientist talked about the possibility of an expert surgeon, being able to kind of manually, or rather digitally from a distance, take over the hands of another surgeon to perform a really careful operation. You know, any even being able to communicate things that are tough to communicate with words, but if you're connected brain to brain, then you could get emotions and feelings across. All these possibilities might now be possible just by being able to kind of hook up people's brains to each other. So it's pretty exciting, if a little creepy.
We'll let that sink in now. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
That's Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He joined us for a monthly check-in on the world of science. Coming up, a federal investigation into Wisconsin's youth prison has ended with no charges against staff or management. We'll find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many of the immigrants coming to the U.S. southern border are traveling from agricultural regions in Central America where climate change is taking a big toll. We'll find out about the challenges that are causing farmers to leave their homes and make the dangerous and expensive trip to the United States. First, a four-year investigation into alleged inmate abuse at the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison is now complete with no charges being filed. The U.S. Justice Department said on Friday there's not enough proof that guards willfully harmed inmates. The probe began after accusations were made that prison staff used excessive force against incarcerated teens. A federal judge later ordered staff to limit their use of pepper spray, solitary confinement, and restraints. The end of the investigation comes as the state prepares to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the facility next door for juvenile girls north of Wausau. The plan is to open smaller youth facilities around the state. Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following this story since the beginning. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, Patrick, we've been kind of watching for this for years now, right, with this federal investigation. It wasn't clear what was happening. Can you talk about now the outcome and what the Justice Department had to say?
Sure. They didn't really tell us a lot. They put out this notice on Friday that they were closing the investigation, that they didn't have enough evidence to charge anyone with a crime. You know, this comes more than a year after they sent two former guards target letters identifying them as people who could be charged with crimes, but ultimately concluded they couldn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt and have concluded it without charges.
And they mentioned in the press release they put out, Patrick, the burden of proving willfulness. So not just that harm was caused by a prison official, but that it was done intentionally. Can you talk about that?
That's right. And, you know, in a lot of these cases, you had these allegations made. They say a young person had their arm broken, and the staff contention would be that, you know, it wasn't intentionally taken. It was sort of collateral damage, or that the inmate had been resisting in some manner and that caused it. Proving cases also was probably complicated by the poor record keeping that persisted at Lincoln Hills for years. So, you know, there were times now they use body cameras there. That was something that in the midst of the investigation they started doing. But for years they didn't have body cameras, and they had cameras within the institution, but then they worked poorly, or they had blurry footage, or they wouldn't preserve footage of incidents, or incidents would happen in places that couldn't be captured on camera. A lot of times internal investigations weren't done promptly, so or at all in some cases, and so you didn't get the perspectives of other staff members, you know, in real time or close to the time of an incident.
Remind us of a couple of the abuse allegations that caught a lot of attention early on.
Sure. Well, probably the thing that got really got things rolling was about a year into the investigation, when it was at a very quiet phase. It wasn't publicly known there was an investigation, but an inmate was being transferred from one cell to another, was standing outside of his room, was complaining to the guards and declining to go into his room. A guard pushed him into his room and slammed the cell door. It was a metal door. He got his foot caught in the door, serious enough that, you know, smashed his foot, and he had to get parts of two of his toes amputated. That resulted in a $300,000 settlement, and then that prompted 50 officers and DC Division of Criminal Investigation agents and attorneys to descend on the facility and grab a bunch of records and interview everyone in sight for a series of days or weeks. And then right around that time, there was a girl staying at Copper Lake, which is on the same grounds, and she went into her room. They weren't watching her. They were supposed to check on her every 15 minutes, and it was nearly 45 minutes before anyone checked on her, even though she had hit a button to attract attention. She hung herself in her cell. They cut her down and were able to revive her, but she's now very seriously has very serious brain damage and is going to require 24/7 care for the rest of her life. She sued, and that was a settlement that was about $19 million to the state.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the latest on the Lincoln Hills Youth Juvenile Corrections Facility. Federal investigation apparently over now with no charges being filed. Patrick, those incidents and that raid you mentioned by the state's Department of Justice opened the door to a lot of what was going on around Lincoln Hills, staffing shortages, use of pepper spray, solitary confinement. Talk about the reactions from advocacy groups and lawsuits filed related to those issues.
So after that raid, there was a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union representing the current inmates, saying that the alleging that the conditions there violated their constitutional rights. Ultimately, a judge sided with them, and the state reached a second settlement that was to dramatically scale back the amount of solitary confinement and the amount of pepper spray that was used there. And amid all of this sort of the problems that are coming to light, the legislature and Governor Walker at the time agreed to close Lincoln Hills, so it's still open now. It's on track to be closed by 2021, though that date could be extended. And the goal now of the state is to have youth held in much smaller facilities where it can be better staffed to inmate ratio, with the idea that because these are young kids, you have a better chance of turning their lives around if you have more of a therapeutic approach rather than a criminal justice approach to dealing with them.
And part of the goal there, too, is to have inmates housed closer to home. Many of the inmates at Lincoln Hills were far from their homes in Milwaukee County. That's part of the plan, right, to have inmates closer to their families, for example.
That's correct. So the big majority of the youth who are there are from southeastern Wisconsin, either Milwaukee or Racine, that area, and they're brought to, you know, north of Wausau, a place where it's very difficult for family members to get to. There are buses that go up there, but it's not terribly convenient. And so this idea that you would be closer to your own community or within your own community, you'd be accessing services that once you got out of the facility, you could continue to use. So there'd be sort of a continuity there. Family could visit you more often. And so they're talking about putting a facility in Milwaukee, maybe likely more than one facility in Milwaukee, but there would also be other ones around the state so that no one would have to be, you know, hundreds of miles from their home.
What's the progress now on finding land for these facilities, staffing them, building them? Where are we on that?
So it's a contentious process. There have been sites located in Milwaukee and then one in Outagamie County, sort of northwest of Appleton. And those have both received some mixed reviews from the local communities. And, you know, I think it remains to be seen whether they're built as planned, how much backlash they face at the local level. There's some concern about those. And then, you know, there are others that will be less controversial. One thing they want to do is expand the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. That presumably would be less controversial because there's already a facility there. It would just be about adding more beds to it. But then, you know, we'll find out later what other counties want to house these facilities. And, you know, it's going to depend on how close they are to homes and what the community reception of them is going to be like.
And briefly, Patrick, now this is the end of the federal investigation of Lincoln Hills. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the state stopped their investigation when the feds started. So as far as criminal investigations related to abuse at Lincoln Hills, that's it?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, it appears that the whole thing is winding down, but this started as a state investigation. After about a year, we had that big raid, and then for a brief time, it was sort of a joint investigation that effectively became just a federal investigation led by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office. That has now ended. Technically, I think the state could pick it up from there, but Josh Call, the relatively new attorney general, has not given any indication that he would do something like that. But we haven't heard directly from him on that point.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Marley, state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about the federal investigation into inmate abuse at Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. No charges are being filed, in part due to insufficient evidence. Prosecutors say that guards willfully harmed inmates. We'll keep watching the ongoing story for the aftermath of Lincoln Hills here on Central Time. A lot of countries have emergency reserves of particular commodities in case of shortages or emergencies. For example, here in the U.S., the federal government has a strategic petroleum reserve. These emergency reserves usually don't get a lot of attention. But a new proposal in Switzerland is making a splash. Why? Because it makes the case that coffee is not essential to life. Some background is reported by USA Today. In their emergency reserve program, Switzerland currently requires the coffee industry to maintain a reserve of almost 17 tons. That's enough to keep Switzerland caffeinated for about 3 months if imports run dry. The new report says, quote, coffee contains almost no calories and therefore does not make any contribution to food security from a nutritional point of view, end quote. Other commodities would still be stockpiled, things like rice, cooking oil, sugar, and animal feed. There's going to be a comment period. If the proposal holds up, Switzerland will stop stockpiling coffee in 2022. Here's a fun fact. The average American coffee drinker goes through about 9 pounds of coffee a year. Our Swiss coffee drinking counterparts consume twice that, 18 pounds a year. Quick thought, zombie apocalypse, coffee supplies cut off. I'm not sure how you tell me from the zombies, assuming I haven't been zombified already. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.